When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hey strangers, today I'm bringing you an interview I did with writer and podcaster Brandon Morgan. You might know Brandon from one of his many, many podcasting projects. I was introduced to him through his great podcast, X Marks the Spot, a true story about a treasure hunt and the very colorful man behind it. We had a chance to chat about podcasting and true crime. Hope you enjoy.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing all right. Thank you.
I was really glad you reached out. Obviously, I Googled you and I see that you were also an actor. Yes?
I was for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have the same sort of trajectory. So I'd love to talk about that a little bit. But I was a huge fan of X Marks the Spot.
Thank you.
Why don't you sort of introduce yourself and tell the folks your story a little bit?
Okay. I'm Brandon Morgan, originally from New Jersey, now in Los Angeles for a very long time. Podcaster by accident, in the arts for a really long time, stage and screen and TV. And I transitioned to writing primarily almost 15 years ago. I did a movie in Romania, a horror film in Romania that took me out of the country for 2 months. And Romania is a strange place, especially Bucharest. It's a very oppressive kind of city, like architecturally. So as a result, I became really close with the director. He was established and a writer at the time. And a lot of our interests kind of aligned, and he said we should be writing partners. So I went, oh, shit.
Wow, nice.
And so I kind of stood on his shoulders for a while and was able to get into a lot of doors that I wouldn't have been able to get into on my own, right? I sold a show to Sony Television in 2017, and I was on the lot at Sony, and my agent was like, all right, this is it. This is you forever. You're a Sony guy now. I'm like, yeah, this is going to be great. Mm-hmm. And I did everything right. Was the dumbest guy on the lot for a while, but not for long. And then I made friends and connections and showrunner people, and I was in the writer's room and everything was cool. But then you realize sometimes in life that there are people that make decisions that you don't even know that they exist, mm-hmm. that affect your life. And so people way above me decided that they could struggle along without me or my show. You know, it was one of those, here's a cardboard box for your sad plant on your desk and your stuff, and give us your parking pass and your badge. Oh, yeah. And see you later. You know, so now, you know, mid-40s with two kids and a mortgage and no college degree. And like, okay, so it's back to the grind. I had this quirky little weird horror script about a murder in my hometown when I was 14 that I had been tinkering with for probably 25 years as a little bit of kind of therapy, right? Like, how could this kid who was my age and a contemporary of myself do something like this, you know? And we got some interest from a startup media company. And I went in for the meeting and they said, so we want to do this as a true crime podcast. And then I went home and I Googled, what's a true crime podcast? So I was left completely unsupervised to write The Devil Within, the first season. And I didn't know the podcasting rules. I didn't know how seriously people take kind of like the journalistic integrity of true crime, because that's not me at all.
Yeah, you're not a journalist. You weren't coming from it from a journalist. Right. I feel that in my bones.
Right. And looking at it from the 30,000 foot view, I understand why it pissed some people off, because the show starts off very, very true crimey. I'm interviewing police and witnesses, and there's crime scene stuff and everything. But then as it aligns with the actual case, there's a point where all of the facts kind of ran out, and it's still open today. People still can't explain a lot of shit that went down. Mm-hmm. So the writer and me, I took it into a very different kind of direction. and it became a Jersey Devil cryptid like origin story.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So what that did was that pissed off a lot of the really legitimate bona fide true crime fans, but it also welcomed in a lot of the conspiracy, supernatural horror fans, right? So the show wound up doing very, very well. And the company that I was at was happy with it. And they said, hey, you're our podcast guy now. You're going to build our podcast network.
Jesus.
And I needed a job. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Of course.
Sure. I know how to do that.
But it was great. So I got to learn while doing it. I got to learn how to be a podcaster while having to be a podcaster. And so I produced roughly 20 shows for them. We had a co-production deal with iHeartRadio. So I was delivering a show every month to iHeart. I also had it in my contract that I could do a couple of shows per year that I would write and that I wanted to do, such as X Marks the Spot. I did a show with Alec Baldwin called Art Fraud that did really well, and subsequent seasons of The Devil Within. And then, as happens in tech and media every day, the company I was working for just decided that they weren't going to do it anymore. Either they ran out of money or they just were interested in other areas. And so no one had jobs again, but at least now I had some IP where I could go and do my own thing. And so The Devil Within was kind of a springboard into me kind of starting my own small kind of media company. So that's what I'm doing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I talk a lot about like life is a very twisty, windy path. It's important to sort of stay open and say yes to things, even if it's scary. How many people have succeeded just by pretending that they know what they're doing? Just pretend you know what you're doing and eventually you'll pick it up, which it sounds like you did. I certainly, that was my trajectory as well. Just like, sure, of course I can. I know how to do this. And just not knowing at all 4 years later. And I know what I'm doing, I think. Although a lot of mornings I wake up and I'm like, what the fuck am I doing?
Right. Well, see, well, that's the big thing. Because I knew as an actor for 20 years and as a writer in Hollywood, all you hear is no. That's all that you hear. All you hear is constant failure. Never ending, soul crushing failure, like on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And so you learn to kind of mitigate those failures and to set yourself up to succeed in the best possible way that you can with little micro adjustments here and there. Okay. And so with regard to podcasting, just to be able to earn a living doing it.
Yeah.
When I was at a company that had money, we were paying marketers and we were paying ad sales and we were paying editors and scoring people and all that. And so little by little, over the years, I learned how to do all of those things. So I could keep as much of the money as possible. So it was worth it. Okay.
Yeah.
So now everything other than ad sales, it's, I do everything. I write, I have a recording studio in my house. I do all of the editing and the music and the publishing and it's worth it.
That's very smart. Part of the reason I think my show is as successful as it is because I have brilliant engineers and editors who know what they're doing. And I don't think I would have been able to do it on my own. So that's really respectable. It's hard. It's hard. I tell people this all the time because, you know, I co-own a podcasting network and we get a lot of people pitching ideas to us. And a lot of them are like, yeah, sure, I could do a podcast. I'm like, okay.
Can you?
Yeah, it's hard.
It's tough. It's a lot of work for not a lot of return at first. You got the long haul. It's like almost like a calling. Really need to have something to say.
Yeah. And it's for me learning that writing is where I want to be. It's sort of the only thing I can think of where you get to do it every week and have it out to people in their ears, you know, and have some modicum of control over it. Because obviously when you work for a TV studio, the words that you write on the page are usually not the words that are going to end up on screen.
Yeah, changes quite a bit.
I'd love to talk about X Marks the Spot because I was so fascinated by that series and then the sort of follow-up, which I honestly tried to do and I quickly learned I was not good at riddles. I'm not.
There's a lot that goes into that. I'll give you the truncated version. So I was fascinated by it, less about the treasure hunt and more about the man.
Yeah. So let's tell the audience the Cliff's Notes.
Horace Finn was a poor kid from Texas. He grew up during the Depression. He saw his way out as the military, like a lot of young men did back then.
And today, frankly.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Back then, I think it was a bit more perilous with the draft. Choose to go in or you're going to go where you're told, right? And he wanted to be a pilot and he didn't have the education, right? You have certain levels of education, but he lied. He just lied his way in during the Korean War. He missed combat by a couple of months, right? The Korean War ended, but he was a very talented pilot, so he became a trainer, and he was training young pilots like all across Europe. And then the Vietnam War breaks out and he's basically in his prime and he becomes a fighter pilot, highly decorated. And then he gets out, the war's over, he's done. And he's like, all right, so what next? What am I going to do? No idea what he wanted to do. Just complete blue sky. And there was a guy on his base that was selling these recreations of this little sculpture, right? And he was like, what are you going to do with that? And the guy's like, well, I'm going to make a mold of it and make more of them and sell them as curiosities from Vietnam, whatever. He's like, oh, that's interesting. Sparked a curiosity and opened a door into the art world for him. This was a guy, no education, knew nothing about art at all. Had a couple grand, had saved from the military, packs up his wife and his kids and drives to New Mexico, to Santa Fe, which was this bustling kind of emerging art community, and opens a gallery. And he breaks every single rule of art gallery ownership that you could break. Thumbs his nose at the establishment. He sells admitted fakes as fakes. Okay. He sells Native American culture in very, very poor taste that you're not supposed to be selling in New Mexico, surrounded by, you know, the descendants of the culture that you're exploiting. But he did it all. He catered to the celebrity elite of Hollywood, would have limos pick them up, would put them up in bungalows on his property, in these bungalows that were furnished with beautiful art objects, and every single thing was for sale. In the rooms they were sleeping, you could buy the art off the wall, you can buy the quilt that keeps you warm, and like everything. And he was massively successful, okay? And he'd always done things his own way. So when he found out that he was diagnosed with terminal cancer, he's like, cancer's not gonna fucking kill me, I'm gonna do it myself. He decides that he's gonna do it in a very elaborate, kind of showy kind of way, because he's a showman at heart. He's going to pack $2 million worth of gold in a Byzantine metal chest, go dig his grave in his favorite spot in the world, put the chest down, lay down on it, and take a bunch of barbiturates and kill himself. So if you wanted the treasure, you had to rob his grave. That's what he was going to make people do. Okay. And he wrote a poem that had the clues in it, but then he beats the cancer. All right. So he's like, so what do I do now? Right. So he's got this treasure chest sitting on his desk for years. And then finally, after like 10 years of just staring at it, he goes, all right, I'm just going to do it because I want to enjoy the chase. So he goes, doesn't tell anybody. He buries the chest in this secret spot and publishes a memoir. And the memoir contains a poem with 9 clues that if you could figure it out, the money's yours. And you don't have to rob a grave anymore. So it happened very, very slowly. A couple people started blogging about it. A couple local news stations picked it up. Then it exploded into the zeitgeist when the Today Show picked it up, live. And they were doing live hits about it. And now everybody, apparently over 1 million people went searching for it. Several people died, unfortunately, because they didn't heed his warning. You don't have to do anything crazy to get the treasure.
Right.
I'm 80 years old. I could go walk to it and be fine and not be in any physical danger. People were scaling fucking cliffs and whitewater rapids. And unfortunately, they died. And so the story came to me while the hunt was still going on. And I began interviewing people, and it was such a strange, kind of scary community. The people that were involved in the hunt, they took it so seriously. And there was a lot of confirmation bias that was kind of going around. Forrest Fenn, the man who hid the treasure, the guy behind the whole thing, was very personable and very friendly. And certain people took that the wrong way, that like, he's a good, close, personal friend of mine. And he's giving me hints and he's communicating with me through music and through like very, very strange.
Oh, wow.
People that you'd like kind of take a step away from on the subway, right?
Right. Oh, boy.
But I had so much fun writing it and researching it and kind of immersing myself in the community while not really going down the rabbit hole. And then about a month before we released, the treasure gets found.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Okay. And I was like, well, there goes our show, because everyone's going to know where it was and who the finder is and like all that. And there goes the show. But then, as only Forrest could orchestrate this, he dies a month after that without making any statements about where it was or who did it. And the guy who found it, a kid named Jack, he always held the position that I'm honoring Forrest's wishes by not telling anybody where it was, because it's such a beautiful piece of land. He doesn't want it to get ruined by people making it like
a tourist attraction.
Yeah, a tourist attraction or a monument to him or whatever, right? So then a community that was already rabidly engaged with this, it just got turned all the way up.
Yeah.
Now it's conspiracies and now it's this, and you stole my solve and you hacked my emails and lawsuits began and all the, and that's when we dropped the show.
Jeez. Good timing.
And then that summer, I Clark Griswold the whole thing. I went, fuck it, we're going. I rented a Winnebago, packed my family up, and we drove to Yellowstone because I had come up with not any original ideas, just piecing together smart people who weren't crazy, a very sober look at the clues and the evidence. And I pieced something together where I thought the location was. And I went, I got to do it.
Yeah, of course.
I'm a city guy. I'd never been to a national park before. Fell in love with Yellowstone. My family had a great time. And I followed the clues. And it was a very powerful kind of day for me. I'd spent so much time thinking about Forrest Fenn and his family. And then I felt like I was kind of walking in his footsteps, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I crossed the Madison River and I went into the Grove of Aspens. And I walk right to a spot and people call me crazy, and maybe I am, but I look down and there's a square impression in the ground that's about 10 inches deep where it looked like someone had dug up.
Sure.
I thought there was going to be a camera on me.
Yeah. You were being punked.
And I took pictures of it and I talked to someone in the community who then leaked that. And then I got attacked. It was crazy.
Oh, shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. The greatest thing to come out of it was about halfway through the show's release, I got an email from Forrest's grandson, a guy in his early 30s named Shiloh, native to Santa Fe. And he thanked me for my treatment of his grandfather and of the legacy and he invited me out to Santa Fe. Since the death of his grandfather, Shiloh is kind of like the wizard of the community.
Did he inherit, was there still money for him? He wasn't like, that was my fucking inheritance that he buried? Okay.
Shiloh's doing great, but also a very successful businessman in his own right. He's got a lumber company and he's very sharp. And we had a great time. And I didn't ask him anything about the chase or about his grandfather, about anything. We just kind of hung out and got to know each other. It was great. And then he's crafty because he, as much as his grandfather liked the attention from the chase, so does Shiloh. Because Shiloh knows everything. He's got every answer that anybody could want. And he still hasn't said anything, you know? And now he's kind of lording over what's left of the community with little cryptic emails here and there and promising this. And maybe there's going to be a Netflix series and maybe not. And I think where we missed the company I was working for at the time, I think where we swung and missed was trying to incorporate our own treasure hunt in the show.
I remember that. And a couple of friends of mine and I had a little group chat where we followed it. And then one of them had a baby in the middle of it. So she was out of commission. That's when I realized I really don't know how to solve riddles.
Maybe to make you feel a little bit better about yourself, I don't think anybody could have solved it.
Oh.
It was so incredibly difficult. I was on all the meetings with the puzzle creators. And I was like, you're telling me what it is and I still don't get it. Don't know what you're doing. And we got all these caveats. Like, you don't understand. The puzzle solving community is very, very sophisticated. And there's a chance that they're going to blow through this like in an afternoon. And I'm like, I don't really see it, but okay.
And what was the prize?
$50,000. Yeah.
Wow.
So they made us clean our emails and get all these VPNs, all of the stuff to protect ourselves. And no one even got 10% of the way there.
Wow.
Because it was so difficult. These guys were so worried. And it was a different type of treasure hunt than what Forrest had created. He made you go outside. Our legal team wouldn't allow that because we could get sued. Like, you had to be able to solve it from sitting at your desk. It was a good try in theory, but in practice, I would do things very differently, given the opportunity to do it again. But it was a great experience. I think it's one of the best things I ever wrote. And I made some really lasting friendships from people in that community.
Yeah, it's a great show. I highly recommend it. If you haven't listened to it yet, go search it up. X Marks the Spot. It's a great binge. And even though we know now that the treasure was found, it's not what it's about.
It's not. What I first scoffed at was, again, I'm a cynical dude from the city, right? It's the genuine folksiness of Forrest Fenn. Like, he meant it when he said, I want people to go on this treasure hunt, to get them off the couch, to go out and to experience nature and the majesty of the Rocky Mountains and Yellowstone National Park and the rivers and the hot springs and all that stuff. And I like laughed it off and went, he's full of shit. It's a money grab. And I forgot about that. And I didn't remember, honestly, him saying that until I'm sitting around a campfire in Yellowstone National Park with my wife and kids and seeing him as happy as I'd seen them in a really, really long time. because we weren't in front of a TV. We weren't on screens.
What year was that?
That was summer of 22.
Okay. Yeah.
It was great. And we've gone back since.
Yeah. I'm writing about something from Arizona right now. I mean, that part of the world is astonishingly beautiful. You know, the Southwest. I often think about like the first people, you know, that like came across that vista and must have just, sometimes I'm like, well, of course they believe in gods or spirit. Like, this is so gorgeous.
You got to write about it. Cause I followed a guy, I forget which episode, 6 or 7 of X Marks the Spot, who came across one of the things in Yellowstone Park for the first time. But again, the first white person. So it wasn't discovered. It was discovered by a white dude for the first time.
Well, my husband and I are actually writing a piece right now about a foppish man going and trying to explore.
Right. And it's great to put yourself in that situation because we've since gone to Crater Lake National Park, right? Which, astonishing. The first time you see it from a distance, it just looks like a mountain with a flat top on it. You have no idea what there is. And then when you come over the crest and you look down and you see it's the clearest water like in the world, what must the first person who saw that have thought, right?
Oh my God.
Crazy. So you have those constantly. And when you drive into the park, the first time you see, it's like that scene in Jurassic Park, the first time that they see the dinosaurs, this valley just spreading out to the vanishing point. And a herd of like 1,000 buffalo just sitting there chilling. And you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. And for people like you and me, Brooklyn and New Jersey, like that's different. That's different.
I understand why Forrest fell in love with the place. He's been going to Yellowstone every summer since he was a kid. His family would make the trip. You know, I get why he'd want to die there.
And I get why he wanted to protect the spot, wherever it was.
Look, I'm 99% sure that I was standing on the spot where the treasure was.
Yeah.
Okay. All the clues, they fall into place. And you understand when you cross the Madison River at Nine Mile Hole, which is a fishing place, you climb up on the banks and you're in this aspen grove. Everything's quiet. You know that it's not maintained because there's trees that are down that are left to rot into the soil to nourish. I mean, it's nature. Mm-hmm. That's it. And you're like, I totally get it. Because to get to that point, it wasn't safe. Right. I was like climbing over fallen logs that were like toothpicks and, you know, branches. And if a lot of people found out about it, the park would have to make it safe. And all of that shit I was just describing would be cleared. And that would be a huge loss, be a huge loss, I think. So I get it. And I hope no one ever finds out definitively because it would be a monument. It would be a fucking shrine to me wanty. I want gold.
Yeah. And that's the last thing he would have wanted. So let's talk about your current show. Tell me where it came from and what it is.
It's called The Devil Within. I was 14 in Jersey. A 14-year-old kid who lived up the block from me murdered his mom with his Boy Scout knife and then killed himself in the woods. And the investigation that followed revealed that he was part of a satanic cult.
Wait, for real? Or like that 1980s satanic cult panic? You know how a lot of that ended up not being true?
Oh, yeah. No. He left contract that he had written out to the great demons of hell, promising to kill his family and himself and to destroy goodness wherever he could. Like he aligned himself with the devil. And this kid was, by all accounts, the dream kid, right? He was a straight A student. He was an altar boy at the Catholic Church. He was an all area wrestler. And it was the last thing that you would expect. The transition happened so quickly, like Thanksgiving of 87, he was his normal self. Okay. January of 88, 6 weeks later, he's the satanic murderer. Everything changed. He stopped going to wrestling practice. He got all new friends. He started wearing like concert t-shirts, became like a burnout. He was blasting music. He was arguing with his parents. He was arguing at school.
Yeah.
And it got all traced back to, he went to the local Catholic school. There was a teacher, kind of a young, idealistic, kind of forward-thinking Jesuit who was like, you know what? I want these kids to kind of see beyond the Catholic stronghold of Jefferson Township. And I'm going to give them a religions of the world assignment where each kid has to write a paper on a different religion, on Buddhism or Mormonism or fucking Scientology, who knows, whatever, right?
Right.
One of Tommy's friends got Satanism.
Which isn't actually even a real religion. Like it was started as satire.
But in 1966, it became a religion because we're in America and we have religious freedom. But you're right. So they're study partners. And the partner gets the Satanic Bible written by Anton LaVey, and they start talking about stuff. And then this cascading series of like things started clicking into place with Tommy. Okay. He was under tremendous pressure that nobody picked up on because everybody just saw him as a thing.
Succeeding.
You're going to win the wrestling match for us. You're going to get an athletic scholarship. You're going to get an academic scholarship. You're going to show other kids that it's cool to be an altar boy. They didn't see him as a struggling 14-year-old who needed a release valve, right? Then he starts reading about shit and he goes, wait, this is all very familiar to me because you learn about the devil from your priest every Sunday. That's what you hear about it. You hear about how powerful and how evil and how dangerous and how they're conniving. And he's like, that doesn't sound that bad. I get to rebel. And so that's kind of where it started.
Do you think he had a mental health crisis? Because this sounds a little bit like a schizophrenic break.
1,000%. 1,000%. Yeah. And I'll get to that in a second. Because what was uncorroborated, but everybody thought was definitely happening because there was circumstantial evidence pointing to it. If you're in the horror kind of podcasty kind of world. I grew up in North Jersey, really close to what's called the most haunted road in America, called Clinton Road. Clinton Road is like a 10-mile stretch of asphalt that goes through a state park that goes to the New York state line. And it's really, 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 really spooky. And there's ruins out there from this industrialist that built a castle there in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. That when he died young, it fell into disrepair. And it was a place where local kids would go drink and make out.
Sure, of course.
It was also suspected to be a place where a satanic cult would go practice. Your armchair Satanists, right? Mm-hmm. People wanted to wear the masks.
Draw pentagons.
Right, exactly. And there would be like animal sacrifices and candles and that kind of shit.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's where people thought Tommy was going. Because there, in some of his writings, he would say the castle. He would say he witnessed a black mass, stuff like that. They don't know if they knew he was there and like welcomed him in or if he was just watching like from the woods, like spying, who knows? But he had some outside influences. One of his friends, we don't know if it's the one who did the report on Satanism, but a friend of his had an older sister in high school that dated college age men. And that dude might've been one of the influences, maybe brought Tommy out to the woods. A lot of it is really, really spotty because the Archdiocese of Newark swept in and said, this was demonic possession. We missed it. Sorry. Stop investigating.
Case closed.
Fucking case closed. There's no one to sue. The mom's dead. The kid's dead. The dad and the little brother fucked off to Florida like 6 months later, sold the house. They were gone.
I would too. I mean, maybe not to Florida, but.
I know, right? Everyone just wanted to forget about it. So
that's
what happened. That's what happened. So we actually sold the show to a streamer, which I can't tell you which one, but it's really exciting.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
It's shooting right now. In Jersey. It's crazy. But when we were pitching it around, I would always get asked the same question because of where, admittedly, where the show goes in the later episodes. It becomes completely fictionalized possession, whatever story that a lot of people, for whatever reason, think that I was being honest, serious about it. But they would say, do you believe in demonic possession? You believe that that happened? And I would be honest. And I would say, no, I don't. Because I think the truth is, as a parent, the truth is much, much scarier than some spook story. And the truth is that every person who should have given a shit, right, from coaches to clergy to teachers, parents, they all missed an obvious break that Tommy had, a kid who was in crisis. And everybody missed it.
As soon as you told me, you know, he killed his mom and himself, I was like, poor baby. It's awful.
And I'm not putting any butter on this at all. This is word for word. Every medical examiner, coroner, doctor, paramedic, everybody who had to write a report and that saw Tommy's corpse that night in the snow asked the question, okay, we're looking for the murderer of Tommy Sullivan. Who did this to him? Because the wounds that Tommy was found to have on his body, medical opinion, couldn't have been self-inflicted. Couldn't have been. However, he was outside in a blanket of freshly fallen snow, and there were no footprints, no forensic evidence, no nothing. Because what he had done was, first he took the knife that he killed his mom with, and he went into his wrist, but like long ways, in between the two bones, and just kind of fucked everything up in there.
Jesus Christ.
Then he took the same knife, a 3-inch knife.
Yeah, I was going to say, a Boy Scout knife is not large.
Shove your index finger.
Yeah.
Shoved it under his left ear.
Oh, my God.
And then dragged it all the way across to his right ear.
Oh, baby.
Severing his spinal column. He basically turned himself into a Pez dispenser. He almost cut his own head off.
Baby. Oh, my God.
But how could he have done that himself?
Yeah.
And they try to trick you. In one of the reports, the final report from the county was that they had one medical examiner say that the neck wound was possible for the subject to take two hands on the blade and blah, blah, blah.
Right, but he couldn't have used.
Yeah, but they point to that as proof. Yeah, of course it was suicide. But then you go back to page two, and that same person says that the left hand was useless.
Right.
So investigators and people in the community, with the help of the archdiocese, came in and they gave three possibilities. Okay, one, that it was the dad, allegedly. He got in a lot of trouble later on in his life with a second marriage that showed that he wasn't really a good dude, okay? That it was members of the satanic cult that came and did this to him, or the church's answer was that he was granted the power of Lucifer to make these wounds. And they apologized again for missing a clear-cut case of demonic possession. But none of those hold any water.
It's just occurring to me that initially you told me that, right? That the Catholic Church came in and were like, no, 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 it's the devil. And everyone was like, okay. And I was like, case closed. I mean, obviously case not closed, but the police were just like, oh, okay.
Yeah. The police, listen, I love my hometown, ride or die. But the police made a lot of fucking mistakes. The police made a ton of mistakes. The first cop on the scene was scared to go into the house. So he went across the street and had a civilian, the tough kid on the block, go in with them to clear the house. Yeah. Okay. So that's an issue right there. Then once they find the body of the mom and everyone's looking for Tommy, at first they thought it was a kidnapping, right? So the cops have to spread out.
Yeah.
No one secured the crime scene. Okay. So
all
these drunk teenagers are walking through the house taking souvenirs from a murder scene. So the scene was completely compromised. And then where Tommy was found, he was there all night. The flashlight search of the backyard across the street and you find him. The dogs didn't, like, nobody found him. There were a lot of mistakes. And the youth detective in town, this poor guy, he was a wonderful man. He was thrust into the role of, now I'm an expert on teen satanic murder suicide.
Oh, jeez.
And he didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a good dude, you know, fake it till you make it. He did his homework. And then he wound up traveling the country and the world, training police departments on what to look for.
Yeah.
Anytime you explain the wounds on Tommy, it gets brushed aside. And the other thing is this, while I was researching the podcast, I do a FOIA request for the records, okay? I wind up knowing the woman at the municipal building. She worked with my mom. She goes, oh my gosh, haven't thought about this case in a long time. Let me get that for you. She's gone for like 20 minutes. She comes back and she goes, 25 years I've worked here, this has never happened. There's a spot on the shelf where the box is supposed to be and that spot's empty. It's never happened.
What?
She goes, maybe they're at the county office. In Jersey, it's not FOIA, it's an OPRA, open public records, whatever. So I got to do an OPRA request, right? And they're like, no clue, no clue. So then I do the podcast without it and I do all my nonsense and cool. And then we sell the show and they have like serious money behind it. So they have private investigators and all this.
Sure, yeah.
They run into the exact same shit.
Really?
Don't exist. They don't exist. They don't exist. They don't exist. Yeah. And they're telling them, they're like, listen, that's going to become part of the story now.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way that's not really flattering, right? Because it looks like a cover.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's where we're at now.
What do you think happened?
I think that the records got lost because it's a small town and you want to protect your police force.
And what do you think happened that night?
Oh my gosh. My answer is going to make his dad sound like a super criminal, right? I don't want to cast any aspersions. I think Tommy was murdered by someone that they either got lucky or did a really good job of covering their tracks, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
Coupled with a police department that was not ready for this type of case.
Yeah.
So any mistakes that the bad guy might have made,
they're gone.
We're lost. Yeah.
Oof. Wow. What's his last name?
Tommy Sullivan.
Okay, hold on. Now I'm going to look through my episode suggestions from my listeners because I'm like, how has this never come up? Tommy. No. Wow. This is wild.
Here we go. All right.
Wow.
Yard.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm definitely going to tell my listeners to go check out The Devil Within immediately.
I did several seasons. I kind of transitioned into I did another possession case for season two. Mm-hmm. Then I got into chronicling like the serial killers that have a supernatural kind of, like I did a season on Son of Sam because mm-hmm. he thought his neighbor's dog was possessed by a demon telling him to murder, yeah. right? I'm in the middle of a season now on Richard Ramirez, mm-hmm. who was a satanic murderer, right? So yeah. just to kind of, I know what my audience likes.
My favorite factoid about Richard Ramirez is him walking into that hotel lobby covered in blood and practically naked and people just being like, it's another Tuesday in Los Angeles.
That's the Cecil Hotel.
The Cecil, yeah.
I did episode, I don't know, I think two, I did a little expose on the Cecil.
Yeah, I covered that one as well. And we ended with Elisa Lam.
Yeah. What do you think happened with her?
I think she had a psychotic break.
How'd she get into the water tank?
I think she climbed into the water tank, and I think that one maintenance guy who was supposed to have checked it just didn't check it.
Okay, yeah.
I can't even think about it. Ugh.
So yeah, so that's Devil Within. It's been very good to me. It was not something that I expected.
It's really another great lesson and just like follow the story where it goes. And also you just never know.
Yeah, and also using it as a means to also do other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that I really, really like. Like I've maintained my relationship with Mr. Baldwin and we're doing two more series this year.
Oh my God, amazing. That's so great.
So that's really exciting. You know, I think the TV show comes out in October-ish, mm-hmm. Halloween-y kind of whatever release. So just the last thing I expected, honestly, the last thing I expected, but you had young kids looking up at you hungry, you know, and they need clothes and they want to play volleyball and do shit. You're like, all right, I don't need to be Brad Pitt anymore. I need to feed my family. And here's a great opportunity and make the most of it. And here we are.
Wow, that's great.
You were an actor for a while, you were saying.
I was an actor for my whole life. I started when I was a child. And
yeah.
I mean, I still am technically.
Yeah.
I don't really pursue it. I recently had the conversation with my managers where I was like, why? I don't need to keep putting myself on tape for like New Amsterdam.
Yep.
I don't see the point. I had a friend who started a network and came to me and said, would you be interested in doing like a Unsolved Mysteries type show? And I was like, sure, why not? And he gave me a lot of sort of freedom to, you know, make it my own. And then I had the opportunity to take it over a year ago. So now it's independent and I own it, which is awesome. Yeah.
I mean, that's super important. It wasn't so simple as when like my old company went away that I get my stuff. It was like an 18-month legal battle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't easy. I had to sign some paperwork.
Oh, geez.
Well, that's why we, with the network that I co-own, all of our creators keep their IP. It's because you're the one putting in the work. You know, obviously we're giving you a platform and we help out with some of the aspects of it, but like you're the one putting in the blood, sweat, and tears, so you should get to keep that IP.
How many shows do you have on your network?
We have three regular shows that run every other week or each week. And then we have our two backbone shows, which is Strange and Crimes of the Centuries. And then each quarter, depending, we have a little mini series that listeners come to us and pitch ideas, and it's fun.
Great. Congratulations on that. How long have you the network?
It's been about 2 years. I think we launched Dear Daisy in like April of 2023. So that's coming up.
Wow. Right?
Yeah,
I know.
It's nuts. And we have a Love is Blind recap podcast, which is just so silly, but we love it. It's just so dumb.
My first show ever that went to air before Devil Within was a Sopranos rewatch with Drea De Matteo.
Oh, nice. I love her.
Yes.
I love her.
Yep. But again, to your point from earlier, her and her partner, wonderful, smart, funny, gorgeous, intelligent. I mean, everything about it, but didn't have the tenacity.
My best friend keeps saying, we have to do a Queer Ultimatum recap. And I'm like, okay. So it takes 2 hours to note an episode.
Yep.
And you really got to pay attention. We can't just take breaks. And she's like, yep.
And what I learned from that, the big, big, big takeaway was creative control.
Yeah.
Because you give two really smart, strong-willed women creative control, you're in editing hell.
Oh, boy.
We were editing before like the deadline that iHeart gave us, like right up until the last. I don't like how I sounded when I said this. I'm going to re-record it and I'll send you the clip.
My partner on the Love is Blind recap podcast is extremely exacting about editing. and has taught me so much. And I'm so grateful to her. You know, we now have like really great engineers, but there was a long time there where we were editing it ourselves and it was like incredibly exact. Take out this like and take out this and, you know, very, the show sounds incredible.
Great. It's worth it.
Yeah.
It's worth it. So what I learned is that since I'm my own editor, is that I need to be a better presenter. I need to be a better host.
Yeah, yeah.
Make my editing life much easier.
Yes, we've learned not to go, and say like every 5 minutes.
Hey, no way, no way, no way.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you reached out and I'm so glad that we made this work.
I hope it's the beginning of a relationship.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. Yeah,
we could do other collabs in the future or swaps or you come on my feed, I come on your feed.
I'd love it. We could do a whole series about Clinton Road, it sounds like.
Man, listen, I'm a skeptic, but that's, that's the shit out of me driving down that road. It's very scary.
All right. Maybe I'll take my family on a nighttime field trip.
Won't be able to handle it. I'm serious. Won't be able to handle it. But anyway, this was awesome. All right. Thank you very much for being such a great host. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for reaching out and best of luck with all the things.
Thank you very much. And please stay in touch.
Absolutely.
All right. Bye, Daisy.
Bye. Hey, strangers. Thanks for joining me for this bonus episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Do me a favor and check out The Devil Within and give it a subscribe. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was mixed and engineered by Jeffrey Devine. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUpod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.